This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues here every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on the Sustainable Lens on Radio here every Thursday night at 7 o'clock and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio. I'm Samuel Mann. A few weeks ago, our guest was Emeritus Professor Sir Alan Mark, who told us about his latest initiative, the Wise Response Campaign. The launch of this campaign was on the 8th of March. A range of speakers from around the country. Last week we brought you Hoione Langsbury, Peter Garrett, Susan Crumdyke and Mike Joy. This week we have Russell Tregoning, Neville Peat, Tim Hazeldine and Louis Chambers. Russell Tregoning is a Wellington-based surgeon.
So I'm from the New Zealand Climate and Health Council, Otatile. We're about 170 doctors and other health workers around New Zealand. And we're concerned about climate change. And why are doctors concerned? The health threat from climate change supersedes that from all the usual killers. What, who says that? The World Health Organization, the World Health Association, recent editorials in leading international medical journals like the British Journal, Medical Journal and The Lancet. These words, symptoms and risk, we doctors use them every day. Symptoms, if we ignore them, we can't diagnose or treat. Risk. Modern medical treatment involves a risk-benefit analysis. The risk of powerful drugs, side effects. The risk of surgery, which I'm involved in, complications. We've got to make sure that the benefit is going to be more than the risk. And the symptoms of unhealthy life support systems that we've got now are obvious, and the risks of doing nothing are great, but we're failing to treat. So our appeal to government here is in these five areas: economics, energy, business, ecology, and general well-being. And I put it to you that these areas all impact on humans' most important need, our physical and emotional health. So where do I come from? I'm a Dunedin boy, born and bred and educated. Three of my previous generations are buried around the Maniototo. This photo shows me looking at an area that was earmarked for open cast lignite mining. Fortunately, some of these plans have gone awry, but they haven't gone away. We've got lignite in the ground. People want to dig it out. They're from overseas. They're going to destroy our structures, our ecology. At the same time, they are endangering our health. What do I do? Well, half my life, I reconstruct by restringing knees. And the other half, I deconstruct. I remove diseased knees and put in tin ones. Why am I talking about climate change? Surgeons are charged to advocate for improvements in individual and public health. That's my college. This is one way I can do that. I think it's the most important way. Climate change threatens all human health needs. We need adequate, safe water and food. We need secure shelter. We need freedom from bugs, clean air to breathe, and political stability. Climate change threatens all of these. Climate change affects health, heat stress, pollution, extreme weather events, food, water security, population displacement, economic collapse, competition for resources, conflict, and possibly war. Who are the vulnerable? Geographically, of course, near the coast, we've heard about sea level rise. Most of our cities are on the coast. The physically weak, elderly, debilitated, infants and children. Our socio-economically deprived, our Māori, Polynesian peoples, our poor people, marginalised people. The politicians are paralysed. The public of New Zealand are in denial. This is a graph showing you an online survey, 2009, hopefully a little better now. The percentage very concerned about climate change and global warming, New Zealand, fifth lowest among 53 nations. We doctors have got to have long-term thinking. Health risks need preventive measures for future good. Think of the hygiene and public health measures. 26 years in increased life expectancy between 1900 and 1940. Why? Increased hygiene, public health measures. Thinking about the future. Vaccination the same. Treatment. High blood pressure to try and prevent strokes. Pre-diabetes to try and prevent diabetes, gangrene, blindness. I put it to you that climate risks need political measures for the future good too. We know what to do to beat this problem, and that's the low carbon economy. And that involves moving to low carbon energy production. We need healthy cities. We need bike lanes and walking paths so that we can get out of our cars. We need public transport. We need to go to buses and trains instead of the others. We need to plug in to electrics for our transport. These things are all possible. We know how to solve this problem. We need the political will. Agriculture, we've heard something of that from the last speaker. Animal farming, 50% of all greenhouse gases produced in New Zealand. Methane, 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Fortunately, not as long-lived, but very powerful as a greenhouse gas. Eating meat is a high-impact activity, and this has been an estimation of the car driving distance equivalent per annum. If we eat meat, and if we don't eat meat, there's a significant difference in car driving distance equivalent. Transport, about a quarter of our emissions. The low carbon economy improves our health. Not just makes it static, it improves it. So if we go to healthy transport, we get out of a car, we do more exercise, there are major benefits for this. The big killers, heart disease, strokes, diabetes and obesity, all reduced if we do regular exercise. It's hard to overestimate the benefits of regular exercise. Healthy housing, warm houses, less respiratory disease. The government is moving on this, so that's a plus. And we need a healthy diet. We must decrease our red meat. The recent evidence is suggesting that if we reduce our red meat, we reduce mortality, we reduce our cardiovascular disease, and we even reduce some cancers. New Zealand has the highest incidence, New Zealand and Australia, of carcinoma of the bowel. We think that that's probably related to our high meat intake. What about our children and theirs? These are mine. My son Mark, my daughter Camilla, my two grandchildren, Ella and Riley. These are my main concern. These are the main drivers for me to get involved. And as Sir Peter Gluckman, our chief science advisor, says, the real debate is, do we respond now? Can we wait a bit longer? If we respond later, the next generation will have to deal with it. It's getting harder all the time. Do we care? Do we care about contributing to the global number one health problem? About giving our children and theirs the downsides of fossil fuels while we enjoy the benefits? The answer is yes, we must convince our politicians to act. Bad policies for climate are bad for health. This is what recent party politics has given us. We've withdrawn plans to tax livestock, the so-called fart tax. We encourage oil use with new roads, roads of national significance. Surely it is of national significance. Promote fossil fuel exploration, coal, oil, gas, let's frack. Gut the already flawed ETS, risk losing control of clean energy with asset sales. Exit legal international climate change efforts, Kyoto Protocol. We're copping out. What are we asking our political leaders to do now? We want a cross-party assessment of the risks of climate change in New Zealand and the world. We want to develop those known strategies to counter this, the major human health threat this century, and to act now before it's too late. Thanks very much.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
Local writer, photographer and environmentalist, Neville Peat.
Eminent and seriously concerned citizens, radicals, change agents and any others, good evening. Ki o hoani tēnā koe I te rangatira te hua. Tēnā koe. Ki ora koe mō tō kōrero I tēnei pō. Yeah, Hoani used one word at the end and gave some explanation for it. I just love to hear it. Māori, as in tihe Māori ora. Māori. It's, you know, Māori have some concepts like that which are difficult to translate into English, even though we have the biggest vocabulary of all the world's languages. It is life principle or life supporting capacity, Māori, just a magical word, and it's one I'm just encouraging you, because as a student of Te Reo, I'm really interested in the words that do come out of Māori language. I have only words for you tonight, not some good pictures, and we've seen some wonderful slides this evening. As far as risk assessment and reality checks go, our national bird provides an object lesson. We adopted the kiwi as an icon over 100 years ago, embraced its name and cuddled its image, put live ones on show at a dozen nocturnal houses around the country, and at the same time we completely overlooked protecting kiwi in the wild. In 1996, ecologist John McLennan and others woke us up to the reality. We were well on our way to losing the real kiwi, the wild populations, especially in the North Island. Studies showed stoats were super efficient killers of chicks and juveniles, enemy number one. The same year, 1996, a community project was launched on the Coromandel to trap stoats and other predators. It was the beginning of a quiet revolution involving independently organised, community-driven kiwi conservation projects covering every region of the North Island. There were 30 such projects in Northland alone on private land, mostly run by land care groups. Besides the farmers, the projects received support from schools, iwi, business interests, local government, nature conservation organisations and concerned individuals. I'm talking about scores of projects, thousands of volunteers and millions of dollars. By far the largest popular movement in support of a native species New Zealand has ever seen. Have you heard of it? Down south here, some of us have, but not many, I would suspect. It is a world conservation hero story. And the Conservation Department was cheering from the sidelines. In my book, Kiwi, the People's Bird, I tried to capture the scale and significance of it. And the reason for giving you that account tonight is that stoats were a eureka moment for us in the mid-1990s in terms of kiwi conservation. We need more eureka moments to do with the risks that we face and the risks that are being crystallized and revealed by this campaign. More the risks that include biophysical or and socio-economic. There was a lesson too from that Kiwi conservation story, and it's this. Communities, if offered the necessary technical support, money and motivation, will rise to the occasion to protect wildlife. Governments should be busting to make this happen. I guess protecting natural capital, whether it's our national bird, wetland habitats, marine mammals or whatever, just isn't as appealing to government as safeguarding GDP and jobs. But it should be. Right now, the government through DOC is trying to partner with business sector and communities to make more to take more responsibility for conservation work through sponsored programs and community-backed projects like the Kiwi Recovery stuff in the North Island. And just yesterday, we heard that DOC has done a deal with Fonterra, $20 million over 10 years, to do conservation work in five catchments. There are big risks, two big risks in my view in this. One, that this reinvented Clean Streams Accord will be a fizzle, as the Clean Streams Accord was, and as my experience in the Regional Council revealed to me. And two, DOC will drop its advocacy role when it comes to river and lakes conservation. How can it be taking the money from business and then in one hand and with the other bashing the sponsor? As I said, the old Clean Streams Accord, which Fonterra Regional Councils and Forest and Bird signed up to in the 1990s, was way short on results. And how about this radical restructuring of DOC right now? It's creating massive uncertainty. DOC appears to be transforming into a hybrid agency, mixing the nature conservation work, its core work, with tourism. Last month I visited the Hauraki Gulf Island of Tiritiri Matangi, and I guess some of you know it. A showcase for endangered birds and reptiles. The bird song is amazing, and the forest bristling with saddleback, stitchbird, kōkako, and other threatened species. But the new conservation management strategy in draft for Tiri proposes a significant increase in visitor numbers, more ferries, double the number of people staying overnight. Key supporters of Tiri are saying these policy changes represent a risk. They would overwhelm the island, spoil the visitor experience, and perhaps impact on the threatened species there. Tourism benefits, yes. Conservation ones, no. DOC has been commanded to partner with more communities, maximise volunteer effort, in other words. Volunteers, up to a point, will support causes such as wetland conservation, the well-being of rivers, endangered species programs and marine ecosystems. In the Dunedin area, I'm thinking of the likes of the Orokonu Eco Sanctuary, the Otago Peninsula Biodiversity Trust possum-busting efforts, the Yellow-Eyed Penguin Trust program, and forest and bird projects. But the community will quickly see it's being called on to do for nothing what the government itself should be responsible for. And more to the point, what it's signed up for through the Rio Summit, the International Biodiversity Convention. There is a very real risk of community fatigue, turn-off, and disenchantment. In New Zealand, and I think for those of you who heard me this afternoon, you will have heard this before, but in New Zealand we have this clean, green, and mythically 100% pure branding. We used to measure the state of the environment, and now we don't. We can just continue with that lovely brand and disregard what is actually happening. The current government has concluded that the state of the environment reports are a waste of money. Can the reporting, opting instead for periodic sector reports. You can guarantee one thing from this, there'll be few and far between. And it sounds to me like a recipe for the shifting baselines I mentioned this afternoon, for those of you who weren't there. You get shifting or sliding baselines when each generation redefines what is natural without realizing the baseline is moving downwards. As a consequence, each generation unwittingly accepts less in the way of natural resources and ecosystem services. This has spawned another term, generational amnesia. It represents a massive risk, the blind acceptance of less and less. And the speakers preceding me have outlined some of what you may get in the future. The way to stop the baseline shifting is, I think, to apply more science and technology to measuring environmental degradation. We have the capacity to do this now. And I think that feedback from this increased scientific and technological work would water the eyes of Parliament, and they can, and that would result in new limits to extraction, hopefully, and controls on adverse effects. Nature will patch up greedy extraction and ignorant contamination to some extent, but there are limits. Researching and setting yields and quotas over water, air, land and ocean resources is what that sustainability is all about and what we need to get back to as soon as we can, because I think sustainability as a concept has largely disappeared. And it has been disappearing since the turn of the century. Staring us in the face as we contemplate this current call to action on the national risks are two words, ecology and economy. These two eco words spring from the Greek word ekos, meaning home or house. And I get the concept of good housekeeping from that. They need to know those two words, economy and ecology. They need to get to know each other much better. And so far we've just had lip service, and that's about all it gets, as good as it gets. Natural capital, which is the clean air and water and healthy soils, is the basis of ecology, the very basis of it. And but natural capital hasn't looked so vulnerable, in my opinion, in decades. Resource management legislation is going soft. The RMA. The government seems to want to irrigate till the cows come home, never mind in-stream or aquifer ill effects. And clearly there are serious effects to water quality and New Zealand's profile abroad, and regional governments too are struggling to cope. Central government seems mesmerised by dams and dairy dollar signs when it should be supporting regional government in the battle to save rivers and lakes from eutrophying. All I can see, though, is from Wellington signals to regional councils that they have a limited lifespan. And finally, there is the sea, the last and greatest challenge to our understanding of biophysical forces and resources. Among the so-called developed nations, New Zealand is an oceanic standout. Sea dominates. We should be a world leader in marine science, reliably assessing and protecting fish stocks, looking for ways to combat acidification, bending over backwards to protect seabirds and marine mammals from fishing impacts, and working out what to do with the several thousand New Zealand nationals who live on South Pacific atolls, I'm thinking of Tokelau and the Cook Islands, who are threatened by sea level rise. And having been in Tokelau twice, I can tell you, 5 metres is about as high as they get above sea level. Sea level rise is coming. The risk is not adequately resourcing. The risk of not adequately resourcing NIWA, DOC, MinFish, and a slew of university marine science departments looms very large. Future generations will look back at our attitude towards marine conservation in the first decades of the 20th century and ask, what were they thinking? Central government, I think, finally wrongly puts most of its focus on economic development and far too little on ecosystem services of land, water, air and ocean that underpin the economy. And just one last thing. I've spent 2 days at the cricket at the University Oval, enjoying it, of course. There was a guy in a black and white T-shirt who came by me with a very long message on the front and on the back. And I'll leave you with the words. The people should not be afraid of governments. Governments should be afraid of the people.
Sustainable Lens on radio.
Tim Hazeldine is a professor of economics from Auckland University. He tells us that economics is our friend.
The title of my talk is Economics is Our Friend. Nervous or skeptical laughter. And I'm going to say that we don't have too much economics in the world, in our world, in New Zealand, in the world today, we have not enough. And if you, I will suggest that if you don't get this, if you think people like me are your enemies, economics and economists are, then you're not simply going to be as effective as you could be and should be in dealing with these problems that we're talking about. It's not too much economics in the sense of what I call economics, it's actually too little. It's not too much use of the price mechanism, it's too little use. It's too many handouts to farmers, explicit or implicit, free water, free disposal of pollutants into the ecosystem or, most seriously, perhaps the atmosphere. And we need to get these things priced. We need to have these things, the people who make these decisions to carry out these acts, to have to bear the cost of them and then to be therefore encouraged to find other ways of doing things. We heard earlier today of the ecological footprint. It's a wonderful, I think of it as a metaphor, but in fact it's a metaphor, but it's a metaphor that also, of course, is an actual measure of how many Earths basically it would take to sustain all of us, the present population of the world, if the present population of the world all had lifestyles like we do. I think that's the definition of it. I didn't know who came up with that brilliant concept. I don't know if you know. And I do know, until I was at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver a few years ago. I actually taught there and stuff, and I opened the local newspaper, the Vancouver Sun, and there was a picture of a biologist called Bill Rees, who with his graduate student was the founder, or the inventor, if you like, of this concept of the ecological footprint. And there's a story about him because I think this is 2007, I think, and he was being awarded the Pierre Elliott Trudeau, or one of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau science prizes. And there was a nice photo of Bill Rees bicycling an old bike on his way to his office in the University of British Columbia campus. He's a sort of, looks like a Berkeley era hippie, sort of beard and shorts and stuff, a bit like Alan here, but with shorts. And I don't know what Alan's bicycling skills are. And you think, yeah, this all seemed to make low ecological footprint. Rides a bike to work and wear shorts instead of wasting textiles. So I thought, well, I'm in Vancouver for another few days. I'd like to meet Bill Rees. So I emailed him. And I was actually only a couple of buildings away from his building. And he said, oh, thanks, Tim. Nice to hear from you. And love to talk, but I'm flying off to Germany tomorrow for a conference. And I thought, hypocrisy. But then I thought, but hang on, here's me, Hazeldine. I live in Auckland, and I fly into Vancouver just to do a few sums and things with my co-author. And I realized, and I thought, I've got to think like an economist again. And the message I'm giving you now from this little story is that one thing I think economists would always urge in all matters is that fanaticism or very binary type thinking, right and wrong, is also probably your enemy rather than your friend. That you, there are changes of lifestyles. Maybe I fly too much. Okay, maybe I have to fly less, although I do walk to work and take the bus home. But we all have different ways of living, and only by accepting the reason for those ways of living and then guiding them or encouraging people to change can we realistically make progress. 2 minutes? Yeah. So isn't economics, when it comes down to it, about enabling people, maximizing, we've heard about it tonight, economic or GDP growth and mass consumption? No, it's not. Economics, at core, is about enabling people to enjoy a good life, a decent life, subject to the constraints that are around them, that they face. Some of those constraints are physical, time and space. Some of them are moral. You may say, well, economics is about free markets. There's no morality there. Wrong. One of the greatest natural experiments in economics ever was what happened in the former Soviet Union and its associated states when they suddenly stopped being corrupt socialist economies and became capitalist overnight. It was a disaster. Their GDP, if you like, halved in a few years because they didn't know how to behave in a capitalist market society. They didn't know the rules, written and unwritten, especially unwritten, of how we behave with restraint. They didn't know the morality of living in the sort of world that we take for granted. So what we need to do on the environmental side is to bring more, expand the morality into more consciousness of morality about the environment, to expand the choices that people have and the constraints that they face, the set of choices and constraints, so we bring these things more into our calculations. Specifically, so that, for example, I remember Sir Robert Muldoon, the late Sir, being mocked, I think, once when he was asked what his goal for New Zealand was, and he said something like, to leave it not in no worse a state than I found it. And people say, oh, what a ridiculous, feeble goal that is. But of course, that's beginning to look like quite a good constraint or goal now. I've got various proposals, which I won't use I'll use 30 seconds on. Compact cities. Manhattan is one of the most eco-friendly agglomerations of people in the world for various reasons. The new localism, pushing back the tide of globalization, has gone far too far and it's kind of going out. Extremes of inequality in New Zealand and the world. A healthy economy, it's based on wellness in all senses rather than fixing things. Trading less, enjoying it more. Clean, green and expensive should be our exporting motto in New Zealand. Get the good price and don't subsidize on the sly. It's not economists. Economists, we have our faults. We have our blind spots even, but it's not the economists who eternally sing the siren song of unlimited exponential economic growth. It's the bloody politicians who do it. And they do it because it's the only song they know. We have to teach them other songs. Thank you.
Sustainable Lens on radio.
Louis Chambers is one of the leaders of Generation Zero. He's recently finished his law degree with a BA in Economics and Environment and has been recently awarded a Rhodes Scholarship.
We do sometimes worry that Generation Zero sounds a little bit too exclusive to the youth generation, so renaming it Zero might be a way to include the room here tonight. I'm going to be quick because I know Alan is being a fierce timekeeper and I'm going to throw my slides out the window and just make a few brief points. For context, I am coming from the background of a group which has spent the last 18 months trying to take on the problem of climate change in New Zealand. Our goal is that New Zealand be zero carbon by 2050, which is absurdly far away, and so we're doing anything we can to do that in the short term, and it's been hard in some ways. That means that some of my comments aren't as useful perhaps to the risk appeal, because it's partly a reflection on lessons learnt by Generation Zero, but there seems to be a wide amount of agreement that climate change and oil dependence are critical problems, along with, I think, water and probably biodiversity. But given that that's such a large part, hopefully my reflections on some of the difficulties we've had can help a little bit with going forward. So the first thing I'd like to do is just maybe set context a tiny bit. Things I've learned. One, awareness raising isn't the answer, even though that's what everyone thinks. The first reaction of every person to climate change is that we need to raise more awareness. But climate change is actually one of the most commonly known phrases around the world. And the idea that awareness is the problem, I think, is flawed. The real Well, the evidence for that, one example is a study just out of the US where they looked at people's scientific literacy. And if the problem is awareness, then you'd expect with increasing scientific literacy, a better understanding of climate change. What they found instead was that people who were more scientifically literate were actually likely to be just as polarized, actually slightly more polarized on climate change than people who are less scientifically literate. The author's theory on that one, interestingly, is that people exist in a social context and try to find ways to be like the people who are around them. And so the smart, scientifically literate people had found better ways to merge into the viewpoints of the people around them, not actually changing their views in line with some sort of objective reality, but because all of my friends believe that climate change isn't a reality, I'm now smart enough to play that game, and I'll play it even better than anybody else. What that says is that the game we're playing isn't a scientific rational game. The game we're playing is a social game. So for me, that frames a lot of what the challenge is going forward and frames why we haven't had action on climate change for 45 years or more, because ultimately it's a challenge of changing society, and a small group of people hasn't done enough to convince people to move. It's not awareness of the issue, but belief or passion in the direction that we're going in. Some particular assumptions that I think we need to make if we're going to take on climate change. One is we're not going to have some catastrophic event which is going to change anything before it's too late. The worst consequence of climate change is still 50 to 100 years away, and most of the ways it's manifesting now are horrible, but tend to be aggregated, disparate events, increased storm frequency, stronger, more common heat, hot seasons, droughts on the east coast of the North Island. We can't rely, though, on a catastrophic event. Similarly, oil dependence, we've still got quite a lot of oil, coal and gas reserves in the ground. Neither of those are going to force things to stop. So the only way to shift before a catastrophe hits is to persuade people to win a public relations campaign, essentially. The other piece of context is that I don't think we can... obviously it's urgent, sorry, third piece of context, everyone knows that. Last piece is that whatever we do, assuming the beliefs of most people in the audience, has to be consistent with some basic principles of human dignity and democracy. So I don't think anyone here is going to establish a totalitarian dictatorship, make your eco-dictator a reality and transform New Zealand's economy. Some people dream about it, but if all those assumptions are true, then what I'd like to talk about is basically a little bit about campaigning and how that might provide a model for taking us forward. If we're going to go down the route of campaigning for social change and trying to transform the economy, there are probably four starting points we need to realise. First, this battle, whatever you want to call it, won't be won in a short amount of time. People went into Copenhagen. That was probably the death of the international community's belief that we could have a global unified response to this. People put a huge amount of pressure. 18 million people worldwide signed a petition calling for a fair, ambitious and binding treaty. Complete flop. We're living in a bottom-up world where distributed, specific actions will build a global picture. That means picking things in New Zealand which we can work on, inching forward incrementally. The second piece of context is that we're not even close to winning the public relations game yet. A lot of people hear the sense of doom, but don't buy the message. They tend to disregard people who really care about climate change as people who are out of touch with ordinary society, and as such tune off themselves and feel disillusioned about the potentials. The third point, which is what we've just heard from our economist friend Tim, is that it essentially is an economic transformation, and I think that point's been made. The fourth point is that we have to take a really hard look at ourselves, because the alternative culture which exists in people who are concerned about climate change isn't the culture which has been successfully mainstreamed. Most of mainstream culture for the last 30 to 40 years, which has been successful and which is idolized by teenagers and young people throughout the world, is an incredible incredibly commercial, incredibly showy, incredibly celebrity-driven culture. That's the culture which has most of the control over the visions that young people have growing up. So unless you can find ways to reframe that culture, then even if you can change small sectors of your own friendship, the greater global game is going to be against you. Lastly, even if we suddenly transform New Zealand's economy into an economy which is low carbon and moving forward, we don't solve the problem because it's a collective action problem. So we have to somehow face up to the fact that we're calling on people for self-sacrifice, even though that won't solve the problem on a global scale. So even though some action might make sense, it is true to say that jobs may be exported to China, because in a competitive global economy, we are having to take action and make a sacrifice to a degree for the sake of a longer term goal, and the rest of the world won't move with us. So what does that mean? Long battle ahead, a minority of people are worried about an area they're not experienced with, the economy. Mainstream culture seems to be against them, and action in the area of control, New Zealand, is unlikely to show tangible demonstrations against the bigger picture problem, which is climate change. Anybody feeling depressed yet? So that's the, I think, a good and honest appraisal of the amount of difficulty that we face. What I would say, given that, I'm going to give a few tips and then a bit of a medium-term strategy. Side note is that on a personal level, I have become comfortable with a reasonably depressing picture, because you, I think, go through a bit of a journey from wishing it would go away and trying to ignore it to realizing that regardless of whether you can do something or not, it is a problem so fundamentally about morality that you simply can't choose not to do anything. So once you understand that climate change, that every emission causes harm to somebody in the future, then it's the equivalent of ramming the knife in every time you join in a carbon-intensive lifestyle. So the only way I've found of dealing with the picture I just gave you on a personal level is to make it a matter of morality, not something about collective action, not something about outcomes, but simply, I refuse to live a life where I am participating in a system which is going to reap massive suffering on large sections of the globe for a significant period into the future. In terms of other factors to take into account on a, I guess, slightly bigger campaigning perspective, the first thing is find allies. Most of the successful campaigns, Nuclear Free campaign was incredibly diverse, had wide participation from churches, councils, slave trade, had significant support from within the system, from parliamentarians, and also from outside, from churches and religious groups. The California emissions trading system, which is quite an ambitious carbon price, was mainly successful because the California clean tech industry outspent the polluting industry 3-1 in the campaigns around it. So you've got to build allies, and you've got to pull together people who all have the same beliefs. Secondly, you have to redefine culture, because culture is significantly against us in the direction that it's going in. That means picking icons, and to a degree that means picking young people, I think, because there's a reason why a lot of goods are marketed towards young people. The third thing is, I think you have to build what I've called strategic microcosms. So you have to choose practical manifestations of the world that you're trying to create, and then showcase those to people. Because even though I've been a bit critical in saying that there's only a small group involved, the beauty of a small group is that if you can carve out a niche which is effective and build the kind of culture you want within that, then you can transfer that in an incremental way to other places. Most of the successful movement theory says good movements start by building from their strongest place. The one danger with that in climate change is if you do it too effectively, you end up as kind of a weird niche eco-community that the rest of New Zealand doesn't resonate with. So you have to build a small strategic microcosm, but have enough of a hand in wider society that you can see how that can translate into people who don't resonate with your way of life but do care about the future. Those are the three tips. The last thing I'll finish on is a little bit about a brief strategy, and that was on my PowerPoint, so hopefully I can remember it by heart. The first thing, I think, is you need to build a platform for engaging people. That's where I see this risk appeal fitting in. I don't think it's a complete answer, but I think it's an essential precondition for having the debate, because you have to outline incredibly convincingly the risks for people. Not because it'll convince everyone, but because having a scientific base to underpin everything you do is fundamental to the success of what comes later. The second thing is you have to clarify the vision for what you're actually talking about. People like Susan and her engineers are able to colour out what it actually means to build technologies, to redesign cities so that they're developed in a low carbon way. The third thing is, I think you have to pick specific battles which are tangible for people. Beyond generic calls to action, the advice I've had is that the only way that change happens is when you choose something tangible which shows the debate which you're trying to draw out. So from a Generation Zero perspective, what we're doing in the coming months is picking the Mackays to Pekapeka Pika Expressway, which is an outrageous road of national significance, funding costing $630 million, and saying that if you believe in a future for your children, it is fundamentally unacceptable to pour $630 million into roading at a time when you're refusing to fund the City Rail Link, at a time when you're refusing to fund the Napier to Gisborne railway line, at a time when you're refusing to fund better cycle infrastructure in Dunedin. So you've got to draw tangible lines in the sand. This can't be a campaign about generic climate change anymore. It has to become a campaign about specific solutions which showcase what it means to move forward. So either you're with us and you're taking this on, or you're not. And that means being a little bit harsh. It means saying maybe we won't take on dairy for the coming 2 years. Maybe our priority is this particular thing, but people need to see that there's some kind of success that can happen. The last thing is doing that again and again and again until you win. And it'll take a long time, but I think there's a bunch of us who are young who are probably committed to spending our lives doing it, and we'll see where we go. Thanks very much.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
You've been listening to a Sustainable Lens special covering the Wise Response Appeal launch, hosted by Emeritus Professor Sir Alan Mark. You can find out more about Wise Response on wiseresponse.org.nz. Sustainable Lens is brought to you each week by Otago Polytechnic. It's broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz. We podcast on sustainablelens.org, and we're free on iTunes as well. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.